Nesbitt.
We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded. Flight director confirms that. We are looking at checking with the recovery forces to see what can be done at this point. We have a report relayed through the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded. We are now looking at all the contingency operations and awaiting word from any recovery forces in the downrange field. Reports from the flight dynamics officer indicate that the vehicle apparently exploded and that impact in the water at a point approximately 28.64 degrees north, 80.28 degrees west.
NASA commentator Steve Nesbitt describing the explosion of Challenger on launch. It happened about a minute into the launch. We have been told by NASA since then that the ascent was normal as far as NASA could see, and that they did track an impact off the coast of Florida in the Atlantic. Paramedics parachuted into the area, and that is the last word we have from there. Again, correspondent David Terawisaki, Associated Press correspondent who has been covering the New Hampshire angle of this mission, Krista McAuliffe, the school teacher on board, a school teacher from New Hampshire. David has brought in a recording of the scene out at the VIP area where they were watching the launch, and here is what was heard out in the spectator area.
That was the scene in the bleachers, the third grade class that includes Krista McAuliffe's son, Scott. He was not with them today. He was taken Saturday night to be with his father for the launch and to be away from the class. Parents and chaperones, about a dozen parents, have been chaperoning the 19 children this week. Everyone turned to each other and looked in disbelief. The parents were hugging the children. The children were crying. The parents were crying, trying to make sure they were keeping track of the two or three kids each they were responsible for. About two rows in front of the parents and right in front of me were Mr. and Mrs. Corrigan, Ed and Grace Corrigan from Framingham, Massachusetts, Krista McAuliffe's parents. They looked in disbelief when they heard the announcement. I don't think it sunk in immediately. A NASA official walked into the bleachers, climbed up a few rows to where they were, and quietly looked them in the eye and said, "The vehicle has exploded." Mrs. Corrigan looked back at him in disbelief and repeated, as in asking a question, her response was, "The vehicle has exploded," and he just nodded his head. I spoke to him later. He said he didn't think immediately. Of course, they knew exactly what he had meant. They were led away. The stands emptied immediately. The school principal, Clint Cogswell from Concord, New Hampshire, and the teachers herded the children or moved the children quickly onto the bus. They were all crying. They are all shocked. Scott is a good friend of theirs, Scott McAuliffe, the youngster. Many of the parents were personal friends of Krista. Head of the teachers union in Concord, New Hampshire, David Staples, is here. He's a colleague and friend of Krista. He was in shock. He was fighting back tears when I spoke to him. And obviously, many of the people in the stands, including the class, had extended their trip. They were supposed to leave yesterday. They made last-minute arrangements, extended the trip to today to take in what they thought would be the highlight of their busy week in Florida. Bob?
David, you were obviously watching these kids. I assume you also had an eye on the launch. Can you tell us what you saw?
I was going back and forth, watching the rocket, watching the kids. I too thought that the explosion was the separation of the rockets from the shuttle, but then it began to appear to corkscrew, and I had never seen that in a launch before. This is the first launch I've covered. I've only seen them on TV, and the first thought I had was that looked strange. I didn't believe that it would make such a gyration in a launch, and thought more like it would be a straight line. The kids, I'm sure, didn't know what it meant. Some of the parents looked as though they couldn't figure out why there was such a zigzag line in the sky. And then when the announcement came over the loudspeaker that there was a major malfunction, a hush fell over the bleacher. Silence, complete silence. Everyone stared up at the smoke in the sky. There wasn't a sound in the bleacher, and then the announcement came that apparently there had been an explosion, and everyone burst into tears.
Dave, you mentioned that the parents were in the bleachers. Was Krista's son in those bleachers?
No. He stayed with the class until Saturday night. And Saturday night, there was a reception in Orlando, co-hosted, I assume, by his father, Stephen McAuliffe, and the wives of the current mission commander and the past mission commander, a traditional reception, as I understand it. Scott went to the reception and stayed with his father after that because of the scheduled launch, of course, Sunday morning.
Do we know where they were this morning?
We were told in advance that they would be in the special viewing area, a building slightly to the left of where the VIP grandstand was, but very close to it, probably within 100 yards of it. So we assume that Stephen McAuliffe, his son Scott, possibly daughter Caroline, who is 6, Scott is 9, were in that viewing area. Mr. and Mrs. Corrigan, Krista McAuliffe's parents, were not in the special viewing area. They were in the bleachers with the kids.
Okay, let's go back again. That was AP correspondent David Terawisaki, who has been covering the New Hampshire delegation, you might say, here at the Kennedy Space Center. All the visitors who came to see New Hampshire high school teacher Krista McAuliffe's flight into space. Let's go back out to AP correspondent Dick Uliano. And Dick, maybe you can give us, for those just joining us along the line here, a recap of this morning's tragedy.
It was about a half hour ago, Bob, when Challenger was on its launch pad and began to lift off. What we normally look for when the shuttle lifts up off the launch pad, it should roll to the right and then arch up out over the Atlantic. We got that. That seemed to be correct. Normally you'll hear a call from Mission Control when they'll say a Roger roll. It begins to ascend up into the sky, and we watch for an ascent really out toward the Atlantic, and then when it reaches about 28 miles high, the solid rocket boosters should separate and it continues to rise. It never reached that point. It was approximately a minute after liftoff when something horribly tragic happened. As Dave Terawisaki of Concord, New Hampshire described, it was almost like a corkscrew motion. And rather than that one bright tail of flame that we should see as the shuttle rises, we saw two, perhaps three. And then all we could see was that white smoke, and we saw drifting below it almost stringy pieces of white smoke, perhaps debris drifting down over into the Atlantic Ocean. This all began a little more than 30 minutes ago. A crew of 7 aboard Challenger, and we've been told a recovery ship has been sent out with medevac personnel, and that's where we stand now. The visitor stand, where our Concord, New Hampshire correspondent was reporting with the children and some of the visiting delegates, has cleared out, and it's very, very quiet now here at the Kennedy Space Center.
Just a stunned disbelief that this has happened after 25 very successful missions for this space shuttle, and 24 previous missions, and this was going to be Challenger's 10th mission into space. Standing by with us now is correspondent Mark Smith, who can give us a little bit more background. Mark?
Well, Bob, I'd like to bring you back to the last time that Challenger flew, which was a mission that ended in August of 1985. At that point, now that was July 29th when it was ready to launch. They launched it from the Cape. It actually got 5 minutes and 45 seconds into its flight when one of the three main engines, number one, shut down. At that point, a computer cut in and ordered the other two to keep going longer than expected, and so the vehicle was able to get up into Earth orbit, lower than they expected, but it did indeed get up into Earth orbit. Now, after the shuttle came down, obviously they took a look at it and looked at what they could of the engines, and they came to the conclusion that some faulty sensors, heat sensors, inside the shuttle had become defective and had been telling the computer that there was a heat pump overheating, as a result of which the computer then went along and shut down engine number one. It was 5 minutes 45 seconds into flight, no serious harm done. They weren't quite able to get up into as high an orbit as they planned. Well, those three sensors were removed after the shuttle landed. Rockwell International, the main contractor, said, well, yes, indeed, those sensors were defective. They said as a matter of fact, one of the company officials said, we found what we expected to find. And so they believed they had fixed the problem. Now, we absolutely must emphasize we have no way of knowing whether that problem was connected with what took place today. I do want to play you a recording of Gordon Fullerton, the mission commander, on the last shuttle mission, asked about those engine problems and what he said when he got back to Earth.
We are going to recommend that they send it back to the shop for an engine tune-up. But once we got it established on orbit, we just had nothing to report, literally. It was as clean a flight as I've ever heard of.
Okay, and I also should go back into our archives here at AP Network News and play you, again, a recording of Jess Moore, NASA's associate administrator for space flight at the time. He also was asked about that engine shutdown episode. And he, too, was not terribly concerned about it.
We are, I think, in our early stages of the operations of this program, and I think we probably had less than 2 hours of actual flight time of the shuttle engine in terms of the ascent phase. And so I think that's a very small actual flight data sample that we have to gain our experience from.
So basically he was saying that they hope they would fly shuttle again and learn more about it, from actual in-flight experience. Once again, we must emphasize that we have no way of knowing, certainly at this early stage, whether today's accident was connected at all with the problems experienced on that earlier mission, which, as I said, went up July 29th of last year and came down after otherwise a perfectly normal flight in August. Bob?
It is, of course, all speculation at this point, and we might add, again, just as some background here, that earlier this morning, there was concern about icicles which had formed on the launch tower. Those icicles, in some cases, we were told, had formed to 1 to 2 feet long, and there was concern that when the shuttle blasted off, they could shake off the tower, possibly striking the shuttle and damaging the fragile heat-shielding tiles. We might mention that that would make the craft aerodynamically unsound if that damage was major. Here at the Kennedy Space Center, the sky was just a clear, crystal clear blue sky. The AP's Dick Uliano is now standing outside, and Dick, we can still see the remains of the steam cloud.
It is. It is still a clear blue sky, and in the remains of this accident, we can see these wisps of white smoke. All that's left, apparently, of this launching, other than the recovery efforts that are going out over the Atlantic. But in the sky, we see these wisps of white smoke. And as Mark Smith in Washington and you here, Bob, at Kennedy Space Center, have said repeatedly, we have no information as to what may have caused this explosion. We don't know. However, I wanted to point out that July 29th incident involving Challenger, that was not a problem it was not a problem with the engines of Challenger. This was a problem with a temperature gauge that told the ship's computer the engine was running hot, and consequently the computer shut down an engine that was operating perfectly fine. So if at all, that abort to orbit that we had back here on July 29th points out another one of these numerous safety features that NASA likes to refer to as its redundancy, another safety feature to protect the astronauts. The computer turned off that engine because it thought it was running too hot, and it turned out not to be. So the problem there was an engine gauge. We mentioned the icicles formed on the surface structure, 1 to 2 foot long icicles that NASA had voiced a concern about. As you mentioned, Bob, we're feared might damage the sensitive tile structure. There's something else we haven't mentioned. The space shuttle is lined with explosives. Now, this is done for a very interesting reason. When the space shuttle leaves the launch pad, it is to arch up over to the right, going out over the Atlantic Ocean. If something went wrong upon its initial ascent and it was heading the wrong way, say perhaps to the west toward populated areas, there is an Air Force man at Cape Canaveral who can throw a switch and destroy the shuttle. That is not what happened here, but I did want to point out that the shuttle, beyond carrying 500,000 gallons of fuel in its external tank and beyond the 3 million pounds of thrust in its solid rocket boosters, it's also lined with ordnance.
We might mention also that the early missions of the space shuttle, Columbia, they were equipped with ejection seats. Those ejection seats were taken out after the first few missions, after the shuttle reached what they call operational stage, and they were taken out for space reasons. So there are no ejection seats on the space shuttle, and of course it would be technically not possible because some of the crew rides mid-deck and the rest of the crew rides on the upper deck of the space shuttle.
Approximately 45 minutes ago when Challenger left the pad now, Bob, our mission clock is still running at 44.36 here at the Kennedy Space Center.
If you're just joining us, there has been a terrible tragedy for the American space program, for the shuttle program here at the Kennedy Space Center. The shuttle Columbia, or the shuttle Challenger, I should say, was about a minute into launch when it exploded.
This is Mission Control, Houston. Repeating our earlier information for those who had not heard it previously, we did have this morning at launch time was approximately 10:38 Central Time, on launch approximately a minute or so after tower clear, there was an apparent explosion of the orbiter. At the time, data was lost approximately a minute into the flight. That was shortly after a throttle up to 104% of the three main engines. The flight director pulled positions, flight controller positions in the room later on and this morning, and was informed that there were no anomalous indications at the time. Tracking reported impact of the vehicle with the water. According to data, that was approximately 18 miles downrange at the time data stopped. Recovery forces being deployed to the field, were unable shortly to enter the specific area because of a continuing falling debris, and at about this time are being admitted to the impact area. Contingency procedures are in effect, and following those procedures, all of the data available in mission control from the flight at the point or up to the point of the incident, data is being secured and will be carefully evaluated. We have no additional information at this time, and we'll keep you advised as other details become available. This is Mission Control, Houston.
So there you have it. We have no word on the fate of the crew, although it would appear that the shuttle exploded without warning.
It would also appear, Bob, that they still don't know what went wrong, because as you heard Steve Nesbitt, the voice of Mission Control, say, they had no anomalies, which means nothing to Mission Control's knowledge was going wrong up until that point, about a minute after liftoff, when the orbiter exploded. And apparently a significant explosion, because here we are 45 minutes after the liftoff, and they're just now allowing the rescue teams into the area of the Atlantic because there was so much debris falling.
And the remains of the steam cloud that was created by the first minute of the shuttle's rise into the air still can be seen here in the Florida sky, hanging like a pall over the Kennedy Space Center now. Earlier today, we have been saying for the past 4 days now, an anxious waiting game for the shuttle crew, and in particular, the first private citizen to go into space. New Hampshire high school teacher Krista McAuliffe. Earlier today, as she climbed aboard the space shuttle, Krista McAuliffe spoke in a microphone check to launch control here at the Kennedy Space Center, and that anxious waiting was mentioned.
Good morning, Krista. Hope we go today.
Good morning. Hope so, too.
New Hampshire high school teacher Krista McAuliffe telling Mission Control that she was ready to go into space. Standing by at the White House now, the AP's Candy Crowley, who has been briefed by White House spokesman Larry Speaks. If you were with us earlier, you heard that statement. Candy, can you give us a recap of what the situation is, what the statement is at the White House?
Yes, Bob. Spokesman Larry Speaks came out and told us that the president was in a senior staff meeting in the Oval Office when Vice President George Bush and National Security Advisor John Poindexter entered the room and told the president of the tragedy with the shuttle. The meeting immediately broke up, and the president with his senior staff went into an adjoining room to watch the television. Speaks says that the president is, like all Americans, deeply concerned and very shocked at what he has seen. Speaks describes the president's mood as silent. He said the president stood there in almost stunned silence as he watched the television. Speaks says you could certainly read the concern and the sorrow and the anxiety on his face. Speaks was asked about whether there was any special thought of course, the teacher that was in the space shuttle, because this was the Teacher in Space program, was one of the president's programs. Speaks said it was not mentioned, but certainly he noted it was on all of our minds.
The AP's Candy Crowley at the White House.
This is KSJN, Minneapolis-St. Paul. If you're just tuning in for the midday program, stay tuned. It will follow as soon as we conclude coverage of the space shuttle accident this morning. The space shuttle Challenger exploded and went down in flames shortly after takeoff from Cape Canaveral this morning. That was about 50 minutes ago. We now return to live coverage of that accident from Associated Press Radio News. It's anchored by Bob Moon in Washington.
Focus more attention on it. As you know, a lot of TV and radio networks had ceased broadcasting the launches of the shuttles live because it had become so routine. And it was as if with the selection of Krista McAuliffe as the first teacher in space, it was injecting new life into the space shuttle program, at least as far as public interest was concerned. And indeed, Krista McAuliffe was described by those who met her during the selection process and those who know her, of course, as a breath of fresh air. She was chosen as the teacher in space last July of 1985. She was 37 years old. She was born in Boston. She had graduated from Framingham State College and held a master's degree in education from Bowie State College in Maryland. She had taught English and American history since 1970. And until her selection as the NASA teacher in space, she had taught economics, law, American history, and she developed a very own course for her 10th through 12th grade students in Concord, New Hampshire. It was a course on the American woman. She was married to Stephen, who was a lawyer, and they had two children. The other shuttle crew members, the spacecraft commander was Francis Scobie. He was known as Dick. He was 46 years old, a native of Washington State. He became a NASA astronaut in 1978. He had received his degree in aerospace engineering from the University of Arizona in 1965. He was a veteran of the Air Force, and he had logged more than 6,500 hours in 45 different types of aircraft. The pilot was Michael Smith, a 40-year-old native of Beaufort, North Carolina. He became a NASA astronaut in 1980. He'd received his B.S. degree in naval science from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. He had served with the Navy in Vietnam and had logged over 4,300 hours. Judy Resnick was one of the three mission specialists aboard the Challenger. She was 36 years old, a native of Akron, Ohio. She received her B.S. degree in electrical engineering from Carnegie Mellon University and a Ph.D. in electrical engineering from the University of Maryland. She had been an astronaut since 1978. The second mission specialist was Ronald McNair, a native of Lake City, South Carolina. He was 35 years old with a physics degree from North Carolina A&T State University and a Ph.D. in physics from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The third mission specialist was Ellison Onizuka. He was born in Kona, Hawaii in 1946. He received degrees in aerospace engineering from the University of Colorado. He became a NASA astronaut in 1978. And payload specialist Greg Jarvis was 42 years old, a native of Detroit. He had received multiple degrees from several universities. And that was the seven-person crew, two females and five males. Back to you, Bob.
Correspondent Leslie Sawyer joining us with some background on the seven crew members aboard this ill-fated flight of Challenger. The orbiter Challenger, the space shuttle Challenger, joined NASA's fleet in July of 1982. That's when it was delivered to the Kennedy Space Center. It launched for the first time on April 4th, 1983, on its first space mission, the second orbiter to fly. Its first flight was the sixth of the space shuttle program. And it had flown nine missions before this one, including the first night launch and landing in the shuttle program and the first landing at the Kennedy Space Center. Challenger was named after an American naval research vessel that made extensive cruises over vast expanses of the Atlantic and Pacific back in the 1870s. And this, as we say, was to be Challenger's 10th flight into space. To recap, if you are just joining us, the Space Shuttle Challenger lifted off the launch pad. Everything appeared to be going perfectly as it lifted off the launch pad, that familiar river of fire that comes from the shuttle's rocket engines. And about a minute into the launch, the Space Shuttle suddenly, without warning, exploded. NASA had absolutely no indication that there was anything wrong. There was an immediate loss of signal from the shuttle, and they were able to track an impact into the Atlantic Ocean. Paramedics, we were told, were going into the area, and we have not heard back yet what the situation is, if the paramedics found any survivors.
No, as you mentioned, Bob, they apparently just got into that area. You said that the flight looked perfect, and indeed, the indication from Mission Control at this point is that there were no anomalies upon ascent. And the only indication of trouble was what we saw right in front of us, approximately 18 miles in the sky, a corkscrew-type motion, too much flame, three dots rather than just the one large white flame, and apparently a major tragedy.
Absolutely stunning, absolutely incredible. We have grown to accept the space shuttle space flight as routine. That is what the space shuttle did for us, is make space flight seemingly routine. Everyone associated directly with the space program, however, knew that that was not the case, that there is always a very real hazard when you launch one of these vehicles.
And you can sense it when you come down here, Bob, because being from out of the area, we do tend to take the shuttle for granted, thinking that it is a routine space transportation system and things can't go wrong. But when you get here, you do notice that there are individuals that are, in effect, putting their lives on the line. And NASA has certain little traditions that prove this to be so. For example, before each mission takes that trip out to the launch pad, they have a traditional lunch or breakfast, depending on the time of day. Each mission has a cake, you know, decorated with their mission logo, their patch. In this case, what we had was the space shuttle streaking across the sky, the Earth in the background, Halley's Comet, and the names of the astronauts surrounding this view, with a little apple between the name Christa McAuliffe and the other payload specialist, Greg Jarvis.
Tom Wolfe, in his famous book that was turned into a movie, The Right Stuff, spoke of the early astronauts as almost as gladiators going to war. And that really was still the feeling here at the Kennedy Space Center, in the space program in general, as the seven crew members this morning left the crew quarters. There was applause. They were there. That also is a NASA tradition. They are greeted by applause, almost as if gladiators going to battle.
Thursday of this week, Bob, the crew arrived aboard T-38 jet planes and the shuttle training plane, and touched down at a runway at the Kennedy Space Center. And as is the tradition when astronauts arrive at KSC, they each address the crowd of onlookers. Leslie Sawyer has pointed out who these people are and a little bit about them, and we thought that it might be a good idea for our listening public to hear these people. We will begin with the commander, Francis Dick Scobie of Washington State. He will introduce the rest of the crew members who were aboard Space Shuttle Mission 51L, the launch of Challenger, with the teacher.
As usual, it's a real pleasure to be at the Cape, to come down here and participate in something that the Cape does better than anybody in the world, and that's launching space vehicles. It's a great pleasure for us to be here. We expect weather like this on Sunday when we launch, and y'all do the best to keep it that way if you would. And what I'll do is introduce the next crew member, and we'll just go down the line, let everybody say a little bit as we go, and
I'd like to introduce my pilot, Mike Smith, who's one of the best flyers in the world, and he's great to have in the shuttle, and I'm glad to have him aboard as a pilot. So here's Mike. Thanks, Dick. Let me echo what Dick said about it's good to be down here and to be flying a vehicle that we know a lot of folks down here have worked very hard on. We understand it's ready to go, and we're looking forward to going to fly. I'm one of the three people on board who's and it'll be my first time to fly. Krista McAuliffe and Greg Jarvis, it'll also be their first time, and we're just all looking forward to getting on over and getting the secret handshake. I'd like to introduce now Judy Resnick. She's our center seater, and keeps Dick and I honest on the system problems. Judy?
Well, I too am glad to be here one more time, and I am hoping that the affliction that Steve Hawley had from the 41D mission specialist of the delays hasn't rubbed off on me, and I think the guys behind me are hoping that it hasn't also, otherwise they might throw me off the flight. And I will now introduce Elo Nazuka.
Let me say that it's really a pleasure to be back. Looking forward to going to fly this one. I think we got some real interesting payloads. The mission is a great mission. We're looking forward to it, and I think we're ready to go fly. Thanks for being out here today. I forgot the one thing I was supposed to do. Let me introduce Ron McNair, who is going to be doing a lot of work with the Spartan Halley mission and carrying on a lot of the experiments that will be going on in the crew compartment.
Again, I'd like to echo the opinions of my crew members that we look forward to returning, launching from the Cape, first of all, and returning here a few days later. I had the privilege of being a part of the crew a couple of years ago that made the first landing here at the Cape, and I intend to be a part of the crew to make the first return landing to the Cape in about a week. At this time, I'd like to introduce you, or to perhaps the person you came to see, and that's Krista McAuliffe, our payload specialist teacher in space.
Again, this was Thursday.
Well, I am so excited to be here. We watched Columbia go over the Houston area this morning, and that was a thrill. I don't think any teacher has ever been more ready to have two lessons in my life. I've been preparing these since September, and I just hope everybody tunes in on day four now to watch the teacher teaching from space.
And those were the seven crew members of Challenger. Again, if you're just joining us, Challenger did lift off the launch pad this morning at 11:38 Eastern Time, and a minute into the mission, a minute into the flight, exploded without warning. There is no word on the fate of the crew.
And no word on what may have caused the explosion aboard the orbiter. So far, we've heard from mission specialist Steve Nesbitt that there were no anomalies after it lifted off, and that rescue personnel were dispatched to the area but not allowed into the immediate area because of falling debris. Were not allowed into the immediate area for 44 to 45 minutes after the accident occurred.
The reaction continues to come in. We have heard reaction, a stunned reaction from President Reagan already through his spokesman, Larry Speaks. On Capitol Hill, the AP's Nora Wolf has some reaction there.
The House of Representatives convened at noon Eastern Time. As usual, the session opened with a prayer by the House chaplain, the Reverend James David Ford. This time, there was a special message.
And at this special moment, let us remember in silent prayer those who were involved in the spacecraft shuttle accident just a few minutes ago off Florida. Let us pray.
The House was to have considered a few non-controversial bills, but in deference to the occasion, the House recessed for a few hours. Nora Wolf, Capitol Hill.
We're looking at video replay of the shuttle explosion, and what we see, it is apparent that the shuttle exploded and fragmented.
From that camera angle, there's no question about it. We saw the plume of smoke, but we definitely saw an explosion, and then the two solid rocket boosters piercing off in different directions, following what apparently was an explosion of the Challenger.
What we saw earlier this morning, about an hour ago now, was the shuttle rising above the ground, high into the sky, and suddenly the familiar plume of smoke dividing and spiraling, and a sudden realization that that something was dreadfully wrong.
The astronauts' families, Bob, are generally kept together specifically for reasons like this, and they would have been together perhaps over by crew quarters or the vehicle assembly building for a good view of the launching, and with them, perhaps would have been Krista McAuliffe's husband, Stephen. Krista's husband was here, her 9-year-old son, and her 5-year-old daughter. And just here to unfortunately witness a terrible tragedy.
The AP's Mark Russo is standing by with us now. This is certainly, without a doubt, the biggest tragedy, the biggest disaster in the American space program, but there have been other hitches to this point. Mark, some background on that.
Yeah, Bob. 55 manned space flights, and never a death until now, in space. But ironically, 19 years ago yesterday, 3 astronauts died on the launch pad during a pressure test of the Apollo spacecraft, the Apollo. Air Force Lieutenant Commander Virgil Gus Grissom, Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Edward White, and Lieutenant Commander Roger Chaffee. They died of asphyxiation. That was the official notification. It was during a fire on board Apollo, and they died in the first 18 seconds of the fire. Frank Borman, who is now chairman of Eastern Airlines, was an astronaut at the time, and he tried to explain to reporters what happened.
First basic deficiency was in the fact that the test was not identified and classified as a hazardous test. Now, this was a failure in the procedures and the management, if you will. Second deficiency was we had combustibles, too many combustibles within the spacecraft, contiguous to ignition sources, and in a 16.7 pure oxygen atmosphere. The third basic deficiency was the fact that we had vulnerable wiring that provided ignition source.
Now, that's all technical talk, but what it boiled down to is that 3 astronauts, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, died January 27, 1967, in the line of duty. There have been many close calls in the space program, notably Apollo 13. That ship was 200,000 miles away from us, en route to the moon in 1970, when its oxygen tank exploded. Left without power and heat, the astronauts crawled into the attached lunar lander and huddled there while gravity carried them around the moon and back toward Earth. America had its first space scare on the second manned space flight when Gus Grissom rode the Mercury spacecraft Liberty Bell 7 in a 15-minute suborbital flight. The spacecraft parachuted into the Atlantic and sank. Grissom had to swim for his life in his awkward spacesuit. Also in the Mercury program, the first American orbital flight by John Glenn. Mission Control got an indication that a rocket package had broken loose and possibly would not work. Without it, Glenn would have to be trapped in orbit, would have been trapped in orbit. Thankfully, it did not happen. The rocket worked, and he landed safely. In 1966, 2 American astronauts came within 3 seconds of death on Gemini 8. The astronauts Neil Armstrong, who landed on the moon, and David Scott had linked up in space with an unmanned Agena rocket. Only minutes later, their craft began to spin out of control. Armstrong, who later gained fame, of course, as the first man to walk on the moon, finally stopped the spin by firing a re-entry rocket. The ship came home safely. The space shuttle program, which had its first flight in April of 1981, has had its share of scares, but none before in a life-threatening category. There have been a number of launch pad aborts we become familiar with when pressure in the shuttle had built the liftoff point, and once there was an abort to orbit, which meant that one of the ship's 3 engines had to be shut down during ascent. But again, there are 55 manned space flights, and never a death until now. This is the AP Radio Network. Now back to Bob Moon, live at the Kennedy Space Center.
And this is coverage of what has turned to tragedy here, the mission of Challenger. Stations along the AP network line, we want to advise you that we are going to be continuing this coverage. We will pause at the top of the hour for a newscast and be bringing you up to date on other news today, and then be coming back to our coverage here. So if you want to stay with us, we are waiting to hear First of all, from the paramedics, the crews that have gone into the area of the Atlantic where the tracking, where NASA tracked the object that fell into the Atlantic. And we also are waiting to see if there is any indication from NASA as they play back their telemetry over and over again. They have just a mound of data to go through if they find any indication of what happened. We can see from video replays that the shuttle indeed exploded. It appeared to fragment suddenly. About a minute before it got off the ground, or a minute after it got off the ground, and now there is just a trace of in the sky of the remains of that plume of steam that that lifted the shuttle high into the sky. The AP's Dick Giuliano.